Welcome, everyone, to the Farm CPA podcast presented by Top Producer. I'm Paul Niefer, your host. And today I'm privileged to welcome Dave Speck to have our conversation. I think, Dave, I met you, I'm trying to remember. We met about 6-7 years ago. I'm trying to remember exactly where we met. Do you remember where we met?
Oh, man. I didn't prepare for this part of the conversation, Paul. I bet it was more than that. I bet it was probably 10 years ago. But
yeah. Well, yeah, you're younger than me. You should remember that. I mean, I'm the older one, but Dave, I think my memory is you now live back in sort of near where you grew up in around Connell, Washington. Is that right? Or fill in the viewers, or the, I guess not viewers because this is an audio, but the listeners, where you're at right now.
Yeah, so I live in a little town called Basin City, and Basin City, Washington is where my wife grew up. I'm actually a farm kid from Southern California, Paul, a farm kid from San Diego. Take that.
Well,
but we ended up here in Basin City, lots of cousins, grandma and grandpa are here, and my parents ended up moving to Washington State as well. So yeah, we live in Basin City.
Well, and I guess like all true good marriages, you go where the wife wants you to go. Isn't that right? Isn't that the definition of a good true marriage?
Yeah, that's, well, she did her part. She followed me around long enough for me to get into this career. And then once I started to figure it out, it was like I was traveling so much, it didn't matter where I lived, but it was better for her to live near her family, and there was better support here. And so, yeah, it's been a great situation for our kids.
Well, and you already mentioned it briefly, but you were a farm kid in Southern California. Let's go through, you know, that history of being a farm kid, and then, cause you're not currently farming, why you ended up doing what you did. So let's start with the early years, and then we'll start going into your career, and then we'll come back to what you're doing right now.
Sure. So I joked that I was a farm kid from San Diego because I had two 4-H pigs, Paul, and my sister had sheep. We had 2.5 acres. And as all of your listeners will attest, that's not really a farmer. But as a kid, we grew up a little bit rural, and it was a fantastic upbringing. And then, you know, then I met my wife, and she lives truly rural. And then we lived in Nebraska for a time, and then the game was over. You know, they told me I was not farm anything. So anyways, that's the story.
Well, but we got to remember that Secretary Vilsack, you know, if you were reporting at least $1,000 of revenue, you were a farmer. You were part of the farmer database. So, you know, that's coming from USDA. So I think you definitely are still considered, if you have $1,000 of revenue from farming, you are a farmer. Now, I will admit I'm being a little facetious there, but
I was going to say the bar is fairly low then, Paul.
Yeah, no, and they've never raised that bar. It's been stuck, I think, in $1,000 for 20 or 30 or 40 years when they do their, you know, when they do their ag census and so on. So where did you end up going to college?
So I went to school at Brigham Young University in Utah, and then I served a 2-year mission for my church in Uruguay. And then when I came back, I still wanted to play college basketball. So I met my wife, and then we got married, and then quickly transferred to BYU Hawaii, where I played basketball, chased down that dream a little bit. And then I ended up finishing at a third BYU campus in Idaho, and then went on and did my master's degree in finance and tax planning at San Diego State. So that's where I did my schooling.
So you did roam around a little bit, and actually I've been on all three. Well, I haven't been on all three of those campuses, but I've driven by all three of those campuses. And the one in Hawaii, I will admit that's a little bit remote.
It's remote. North Shore.
Yeah. Of course, Rexburg, you know, that's not a thriving metropolis of Idaho either. So that's a little bit remote too. So, but so you got your degree from San Diego State, and then how did you end up going to Nebraska, and what were you doing when you're in Nebraska?
Yeah. So I graduated with my master's. While I was doing my master's degree, I started an internship with LPL Financial, putting together financial plans for advisors that were then delivering those plans to their clients. A couple of years into that job, I was a part of starting a consulting practice, working with the top financial advisors on profitability. And one of them happened to be in Nebraska. I really took an interest during my master's degree in family-owned businesses and wanted to get out of the big corporation and build a practice around family-owned businesses. And so this guy I was doing consulting work for in Nebraska, you know, told me he had an opportunity. And so my wife and I, you know, took a chance and we moved our family to Nebraska. And as soon as I got there, I realized, you know, I'm in the business development business and I don't know anyone. And so I went to the University of Nebraska and I told them, you know, that they needed to have a family business program because they were training the next generation of owners, you know, but they could teach them finance and marketing and everything else. But if they couldn't help them navigate the challenges of being a family owned business or being a family owned ranch, that none of those skills were really going to be put to great use. And so I convinced them to start a program. And then they told me, well, we don't have any money. So I went out and fundraised enough so that I could actually teach the class and get the program started. And so I developed their family business management program with the help of some really generous donors. And from there, I became known the farm whisperer, Paul, and really started working with a lot of farmers and ranchers in Nebraska and then all over the country. And, you know, Paul, my passion is really, and my kind of my focus is on preserving family relationships and perpetuating farms or perpetuating businesses in that order. And I feel like oftentimes, you know, we get it out of order. And we're so focused on perpetuating the farm that, you know, we don't think about the structures and how those structures, you know, interact with the relationships and the humans. And so, you know, that was a real focus of mine and is a focus of mine today.
Yeah, I think certainly, and I had another call today dealing with some succession planning for a family farm operation in Oregon. And it's very apparent that these two families should not be farming together. I mean, they're you know, brother, sister, but the next generation and so on, they really should not be farming together. But the issue is that because of the structure of the land and the structure of the farm and the structure of everything, that what should happen immediately would be so onerous from an income tax standpoint that we have to then sort of keep it together for at least another 5 years, because it's going to take that amount of time to be able to split up the farm corporations, because it's structured as a corporation and you can't split up a farm corporation unless it's being ran as a business for at least 5 years. Well, this is the land holding side. It's not been run as a business. So now we have to run it as a business for 5 years, and it's just going to be difficult to really get it into that structure that we need it to be. Whereas if it was not in that corporate structure, it would have been much easier to split it up and we could have done it immediately, and both sides of the families could be doing their own deal and so on and so forth. So that's the problem sometimes, that, yeah, we know we got to do this, but, you know, the tax situation just comes in and bites farmers, and you see it over and over and over. But I guess I need to get off my high horse. So you're in Nebraska, you're helping develop, or you developed the family business. How many years did you end up doing that?
So I taught at the University of Nebraska for 3 years. The program started in the College of Business, and then quickly we went over to Ag Economics. And so I ended up teaching in Ag Economics and in the College of Business because there were so many farm and ranch kids. And then we had our kind of college city campus where it was more, you know, city businesses that would kids from city businesses that would come to that class. So it was pretty interesting.
Yeah, because University of Nebraska, Omaha, that's right, you know, just west of downtown a little bit. I mean, what is it, the equivalent, about 40th and Dodge, something like that. I was just in Omaha last Monday, Tuesday. So Yeah, I've been to Omaha too many times. So
yeah, we were in Lincoln with the where the university plays football and things like that. But
yeah,
Omaha's just up the road.
Of course, lately the university in Lincoln maybe hasn't had the best football team. They almost almost maybe beat Ohio State, but they could have done a little bit better on that. But so you were there.
I shouldn't have brought up football, Paul.
Yeah. So you were there for 3 years, and then what did you do after that?
So after 3 years, my wife and I decided we wanted to get closer to her parents. And I was traveling all over the country at that point, doing a lot of speaking and consulting. And so actually the majority of my business was not in Nebraska. And so it didn't really matter that we stayed there. And so we ended up moving to Washington State, and I would travel back and forth to Nebraska to take care of some clients. But we made that transition at that point, mostly just for family reasons.
Okay. And then, so what are you doing? What are you doing right now?
So currently I'm the director of the Global Family Business Institute at the Drucker School of Management, and that's connected to Claremont Graduate University. I just joined about 6 months ago. Prior to that, I was at Wells Fargo Private Bank for about 5 years, helping to lead their family dynamics program, where we focused on, you know, all the non-financial challenges that business owning families and farm and ranch families face as they're trying to perpetuate their enterprises.
Okay. So, you know, the one thing that I'd sort of asked you to mull on a little bit for this podcast is, I wanted to maybe you could take not necessarily a real life example, but similar to real life example of a family farm transition or ranch transition, both that was successful and maybe wasn't successful. So I'm going to ask you, which one would you like to start with first?
Well, I think we start with success first. It's easy to go to failures. Let's start with success first.
Okay.
You know, I'll just say from a thematic standpoint, I can think of a number of families, but the common theme that they played out was, you know, they had what I call the three C's in order. And those three C's are contingency plans, cash flow plans, and communication plans. So, you know, as I think about these families, and we'll start with contingency plans, you know, Paul, I'm always surprised how few could describe just in normal terms what would happen to the assets, how assets would flow if any of the owners were to pass away. I don't know why that is so difficult or so challenging, but many can, you know, really struggle to do that. And if they don't know, then you can imagine that their family members, they definitely don't know. And so, you know, the successful families really take seriously putting contingency plans in place, which I mean basically as plan B. You know, if everything doesn't go according to plan and something happens, you know, how do assets flow? On the management side, mm-hmm. you know, the families that are successful are actively looking to close the gap between those that are doing a certain job and those that would have to do a job if they were gone on Monday. And whether that's the relationship with the banker, the relationship with the CPA, you know, how to actually run the financial parts of the farm, you know, we need to actively look at what is the knowing doing gap between people that are making decisions currently and those who would be asked to fill in if that person were gone. Anyways, let me just stop there. I mean, Paul, I'll turn the tables on you for a second. How many, you know, what's the likelihood of a lot of clients that you have just having clear contingency plans for both ownership and management? How frequent do you see it?
Oh, I'm going to say in the farm arena, it's probably that could describe it and know what it was. It'd probably be 20%, could be 30%. Now, maybe that's a fault of me, you know, not being able to help them understand that or sit down with them. I mean, I think with a lot of my clients, I go through that. But, you know, that is something that you're correct. I mean, they really don't understand what would happen if they walked out tomorrow and got killed in a car wreck. You know, that's that is definitely the reality.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I like to talk about it from, I mean, it's interesting to think about, like, what button do you need to push to get someone to really consider that type of planning? Sometimes it is, you know, the continuity of the farm. But what I've noticed is that when an owner realizes that, you know, relationships between his children are in jeopardy unless they put those plans in place, oftentimes that can be the button that gets pushed that allows us to move forward and help them put those plans in place. So, you know, that's the first thing, is those contingency plans. The second, and you see this all day and every day, is cash flow plans, both for a senior generation and how are they going to have the cash flow they need to have the type of, you know, retirement that they want. And then the cash flow needs of the operation, and how do those two interact with each other? There's just so few that have actually taken the time to think through and be able to articulate where that cash flow is coming from for that senior generation that may want to step away or step back. And also for the younger generation, for them to have a clear understanding of what the cash flow looks like for the operation, to know, you know, is there room to grow here? You know, who can come back? And so that's the second one, is just cash flow.
Yeah, I remember doing a column for Top Producer Magazine, you know, several years ago. And I think I titled it something along the lines of "Know Your Economic Units." So in your operation, how many economic units do you need? So if there's mom and dad and two sons, I call that sort of three economic units. You got to generate enough cash flow to cover those three economic units. And if you're not at that level, you got to figure out how you're going to get to that level and if it's even achievable. So I definitely agree with you. You got to have that cash flow plan.
Yeah. So contingencies, cash flow planning, and then the third one is just communication. And it's all about creating expectations. And, you know, a lot of times people don't want to share their financial situation with their children. They are not sure about sharing their succession plan because they don't want to ruffle feathers. But ultimately, everyone is creating an expectation, whether that expectation is founded on reality and truth, or we're just making it up in our minds. And I try to get farmers to realize this, is that it's better for you to set the expectation than for your kids to dream up what that expectation is going to be. Because, you know, when the dream is not the reality, is when, you know, there's typically big problems.
Yeah. Speaking of that, you know, cause I've had conversations with others that, you know, when you're having that meeting where it's, you know, the first generation and the second generation, a lot of people are hesitant to include the daughter-in-law, the son-in-law in those conversations. And sort of how I view it, well, if you don't include, and you sort of brought it up already, but if you don't include that daughter-in-law or son-in-law, but you're including your daughter and your son, the communication isn't from you to the daughter-in-law and the son-in-law. The communication is from you to your children, and then they're going to communicate to their spouse when they get home. And a lot of times what the child is communicating to the spouse is not anywhere near what you communicated. So if you want them to understand, like you say, what the expectations are, you need to be communicating it. Is that something you typically see in a successful family, that they're including those daughter-in-laws and son-in-laws just to make sure that everybody understands what's going on?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll give you an example. There was a family that I was working with. There were eight kids in the family. Actually, there were nine kids in the family. And there was a shared family cabin. And so they have family meetings to decide, you know, who gets to use it and when, and maintenance and all these other things. And they determined that they would include all spouses. So all spouses get to have a voice and get to communicate their, you know, what they think, but ultimately the vote comes to the kids, you know, to the blood relatives. And so I thought that was a good way to do it, because, you know, it's good to have their voice at the table, but it's also good for them to know that ultimately the family has to make decisions based on, you know, who actually owns it. And so that was right. that was just one example of a way to be inclusive, but also to not give up control.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of like having, you know, a board of directors that have both voting and non-voting, powers, you know, that board, the board member that has non-voting, they're still able to provide information, provide feedback, you know, explain, hey, you might be doing this wrong, but ultimately it comes down to the voting members, which actually probably have the ownership. So I think I sort of view it the same way.
Yeah. One last thing that I see as a common theme for successful families is they develop an ownership mentality in their kids at a young age. And what I mean by that is that, they allow them to understand the actual cost of raising an animal or raising a crop. They let them invest some of their own money and they allow them to feel what it feels like to succeed or to struggle. And if they have a realistic expectation of ownership, especially when they come back early, you know, and there's some way to participate in feeling like and acting like an owner, Paul, it's just a totally different experience for them when it comes time to actually succeed their parents or whoever it is that they're following.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Well, I think, Dave, before we go into a discussion of what might go wrong in succession plan, and like we know, there's plenty of times when it does go wrong, we're actually going to go ahead and take a quick break for a sponsor message right now, and then we'll come back and finish up the conversation.
Get timely updates about taxation, accounting, succession planning, and other issues that are unique to farmers and agribusiness processors. Find out about major agribusiness events and how to comply with new laws that affect your business. Subscribe to Farm CPA at blogs.claconnect.com/agribusiness and experience the CLA promise. blogs.claconnect.com/agribusiness.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Farm CPA podcast presented by Top Producer. I'm Paul Niefer, your host, and we're going to rejoin our conversation with David Speck. And, you know, David, right before the break, we were talking about, you know, sort of, and you came up with the three C's. You have the contingency plan, you have the cash flow plan, and you have the communication plan. And those are the three C's that really you see when you have a successful family transition, you know, to that next generation. Now let's dig more into what do you see, what's the maybe the lack of the C's, or there's D's or E's or F's that are involved that really ends up having a bad transition.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're kind of directly on the flip side, but I'll give you some examples here. There's a number of, you know, farmers that I've met that have plans, that have spent money with an attorney, that have a CPA that's working for them. And when you ask if they have a plan, they say, yes, they do, but then they cannot describe that plan or don't really know how it works. Even worse is when a spouse is not involved in crafting that plan, or when kids don't know what's in that plan. And I like to think of it as, you know, if you're putting a succession plan together, you know, there's only one thing that makes it a plan that's being done for them or being done to them, and that's communication. Yep. And we hit on it earlier, but, you know, just not having all the voices at the table necessary to put together a thoughtful plan, I think is a huge problem. And I'd be curious, you know, in your CPA role, how often families are actually including multiple generations in having them have a voice at the table before the structure is put in place, or are they just explaining that structure once it is put in place?
You know, I think clients I work with, typically, I'm just thinking, matter of fact, I had a call today. It was with the first and second generation the Oregon call. That was actually with the CPA for them, but that one actually might end up being a little bit more dealing with the first generation first, because it's so tied up in the tax side. So that's probably just not a good example. But I had a meeting in Oklahoma a while back, and that has both generations. Actually, third generation is not old enough yet. I mean, we're talking, you know, still minor children and so on in most cases. So I think it just depends. But I've had other cases, like you said, hey, we're only meeting with the first generation or the older generation, and they hesitate to bring in the younger generation until they have the plan all set. And then a lot of times it I don't know if it's inertia, but they just don't even get a plan done. So it's all across the board. I don't know what you see on your side.
Yeah, I mean, it seems more complicated and complex to involve multiple generations, but as long as the expectation is set that we're bringing you here to the table to give you a voice so that we can make a decision and put things in place, taking your voice into account. Not necessarily are we going to execute on all the things that you want, but as long as those expectations are put in place, they're brought to the table to have a voice, and then they trust that the senior generation and those that are in charge of putting that plan together ultimately, you know, want their perspective, then it works much better. I would also say, go ahead.
No, you go ahead and then I'll come back.
I was going to move on to another point. So,
okay. Well, I guess how often as a independent advisor in your role, have you had that conversation with the older generation than the younger generation, and you come to find out the younger generation, the only reason they're on the farm is because they thought the older generation expected them to be on the farm, or vice versa? Do you see that happening very often? I mean, I've run across that, you know, just a very few times, but it's like, oh man, you know, they've I won't say they've wasted 10 or 20 years of their life, but they really could have been doing something else that they had more of a passion for.
Yeah, you do see it. I mean, the really sad ones are the ones where, you know, there's someone back on the farm or ranch and their expectation was that they would take it over and that they would become an owner, only to find out that they're also going to share ownership with all their non-operating siblings and ultimately not have control of the farm or ranch. I mean, that after being out there for 10 or 15 or 20 years, that is truly heartbreaking for people.
Yeah. I mean, just for like me personally, my two older sons, they ended up becoming CPAs. Well, one never got his license, but they both, were working at a CPA firm, found out they didn't like it. And I think one of them even called up my wife and said, "Hey, is Dad going to be mad that I don't want to be a CPA? I want to do something else." And she asked me, and I'm like, I never asked them to be a CPA. Yes. I mean, they need to do whatever they want to do. Now, interestingly, that's the one that for his birthday, which was 2 days ago, he's actually, believe it or not, a professional daily fantasy sports player. And he won $240,000 playing fantasy sports on Sunday. So that was a good birthday present for him. But and he's been doing that for, I think, 7 years now, 6 years. And he's not on my payroll, so I can't say too much about it. So his best skill is basketball. I mean, he understands the basketball side. So, were going to start up another comment.
Yeah. One other thing where I see, families falling short and really struggling is when they don't prepare the rising generation in a couple of specific areas. The one is financially. In farming, I see, a lot of rising gens that are basically taking over the operation as, knowing how to do the work and getting the work done, but some don't have any idea, what the break-even point is, what it takes to be profitable. And then the second piece, so that's financial, but then the second transition that never happens is the relationship transfers. Oftentimes, mom and dad have relationships you know, with the seed dealer, or they have relationships with the banker, or they have relationships with the attorney or the CPA. And ultimately, they don't involve the rising generation early enough in those relationships. And then if something suddenly happens to that senior generation member, you know, there's this gap. And maybe there's a gap in trust, there's a gap in experience. And so, you know, those are the things that I worry about the most, is that that knowledge is not being transferred from the financial part of how to run the farm, how to understand that it's going to be profitable. And then also, what are the relationships that they should actively be working on transitioning to that rising generation? So those are a couple things that I see, you know, all too frequently.
You brought that up, and I was just thinking back to my own personal experience. You know, I had a pretty major bout of COVID earlier this year, and I get done with it, and I'm sitting home with my wife on the couch, and she goes, "Hey, Paul, where's your go box?" And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And she goes, "Well, when you pass away, because with this COVID, you're probably going to die here fairly quickly, I need to know where to go to get the box that tells me everything you got going on." So I said, I don't think I'm quite there yet, but it is something that, as I thought about it, you know, because I think she was joking a little bit, at least I hope she was joking. It is important. Hey, I have a lot of things that the knowledge is in my head. You know, I've done an okay job of putting it in a place, but I probably haven't written down as much as I. It's just like, you know, all of our financial data is on QuickBooks. Well, I'm the only one that really knows the password, and which even know where to find it. You know, and now my son, my oldest son, who's, you know, fairly successful in business, he understands a lot of that stuff, but still he would have some issues, you know, finding that. So I need to do that. I'm just curious. You probably in Nebraska, you would have worked with a lot of ranches, and you would have worked with a lot of what I call more row crop farmers, you know, corn and soybeans, maybe some wheat and alfalfa and so on. Could you say, would ranchers be more successful than crop farmers, or opposite, or is it really across the board?
Boy, I would say it's they all struggle, especially with succession and preparing that rising generation. And it just depends on, I mean, there are some that are just really great at growing the crop and really struggle just because of a lack. They're not that interested in the business side. And then there's others that are, you know, really business oriented and still, you know how to grow a great crop, and they really succeed and thrive. So it depends on kind of partnerships too. I mean, oftentimes it's a spouse partnership, where oftentimes the, you know, one spouse is very much running the finances and making sure the bills get paid, and the other is, you know, outside doing outside work. And so, you know, I can't say that there's one type of farmer or rancher that's better or worse at it, but you know, these things are pretty much across the board challenging for agriculture.
Well, Dave, this has been very interesting. I mean, I think it's great to understand what a successful transition is, but we also understand that it can be difficult. It requires both maybe some hard work, but some hard choices. I mean, these are not always easy choices. But, you know, it's stuff that you need to do it during your lifetime. If you just wait until you pass away, you really effectively haven't done your job. I mean, that's not what I call a good transition plan. So I guess for you personally, what keeps you up at night? Is there anything that in your current role that you worry about that might be keeping you up at night?
Well, I have six kids, Paul, so I have plenty to keep me up at night. But beyond them keeping me up at night, as I think about our friends in agriculture, it really is, you know, these relationships. I worry about these family relationships that are in jeopardy because parents putting their kids in shared ownership when they don't prepare them, or, you know, not having their kids feel what ownership feels like, and having a proper understanding of what it means to be an owner, not only the rights, but more importantly, the responsibility that comes with being an owner. You know, I worry about the rising generation not understanding exactly, you know, what it feels like to have the leverage that their parents have lived with their whole life. And so those are all things that I worry about. But, you know, ultimately it takes education, and then it takes someone, it takes, you know, a team of professionals to continue to nudge them forward and remind them that, look, the farm isn't the only thing in jeopardy. It is those family relationships. And I think we need to continue to nudge them to do the hard work and to put these plans in place and to communicate and communicate and communicate again.
Yep. Yep. And then finally, I always end my conversations with what is your definition of success in farming? I think we've sort of hit on it a little bit here, but you know, if you could just shrink it down to a little nugget, what's your definition of success?
Yeah. I mean, when you talk about generational farming, it's when, you know, there's multiple generations who share a passion for agriculture. And ultimately when that comes together, that is fantastic to see. And that is true success. I would also say when it's discovered that the rising generation does not want to own and manage the farm, I think success is helping that senior generation know how to unwind it and to get out of it and to not leave, a burden on their kids. And so there's a lot of different definitions of success. But again, I go back to, you know, what's best for the family relationships. And ultimately, if it is in the cards, I'd love to see these farms perpetuated across generations. Because these families are great stewards, you know, they're great stewards of the land. And that's how I define success.
Okay, well, perfect. Well, Dave, thank you very much. I think this has been very informative for our listeners out there. We typically speak more with farmers, but I like bringing in other people, other professionals and so on that work with farms. And I know that's something you definitely have a passion for.
Thanks, Paul. It's been fun.
Thanks a lot. Okay. This is Paul Niefer signing off. This has been the Farm CPA podcast presented by Top Producer.